All right, we're underway here with the First Regathering, session 34, and we're picking it up on page 249 of your notebook. Just a quick review, very fast. Session 33 was the DVD, Israel, a Nation is Born, Part 5. We looked at the events from 1973 to 1991 through the eyes of the Foreign Minister Abba Iban. So kind of a classic series on the history of Israel. Although you can't jam the years 1973 to 1991 into an hour and really get it in depth, but at least you get an overview of it. Alrighty, let's pick it up now on page 249 with September 28, 1995, Oslo II. Everybody there, top of page 249. And again, you'll notice that a lot of these this information comes out of the news, the current news of the day. I just, in trying to keep up with this class over the years, I've just collected news articles and then tried to cull them down to the ones that were most pertinent. Okay, from the Jerusalem Post, Jerusalem Report, October 19th. Over a year behind schedule, after weeks round-the-clock talks, Foreign Minister Peres and PLO Chairman Arafat finally completed the Oslo II Accord on September 24th. Under the deal signed by the White House on September 28th, Israel will pull out of all West Bank cities in the next 6 months. And again, you can see as we read this, the high hopes for the plans and how little has actually happened. With the exception of Hebron, where a small army presence will remain to safeguard settlers, and also hand civil control of 450 Palestinian towns and villages to Arafat's Palestinian Authority. Early next year, the Palestinians will hold an election for an 82-member governing council. Within 2 months of the council's inauguration, the PLO is obligated to excise anti-Israel clauses from its covenant. Think that's been done? Israel also agreed to a phased release of Palestinian prisoners and to Palestinian control of the West Bank holy places, with the exception of Hebron's Cave of Machpelah, Joseph's tomb in Nablus, and Rachel's tomb in Bethlehem. During the signing ceremony, Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin commented, "We are not retreating. We are not leaving. We are yielding. We are doing so for the sake of peace." So the agreement effectively ends Israel's 28-year occupation of the West Bank cities, though it technically leaves Israel with at least temporary control over three-fourths of the territory. No less critically, it makes territorial compromise between Israelis and the West Bank Arabs inevitable. So this map is a map of the, you don't have this map, I believe, no, you don't have this map, is a map of the Oslo II agreement. The pink areas, the reddish areas, which would be our Palestinian cities. The gold area, the yellowish areas, are Palestinian villages. And Area C is the Israeli settlements and military areas and state lands. So that was the idea of how the West Bank would be divided up under Oslo II in 1995. Now, this chart on page 250, you have a chart, negotiations with the Palestinians. We're now on the third column. We've advanced to the third column. And so we're looking at Oslo II, or it's also called the Interim Agreement. As you can see on the chart, it's described as a comprehensive agreement on the transfer of powers and responsibilities in the West Bank and Israel to an elected Palestinian council as follows. December 31st, 1995, IDF redeployment from the West Bank populated areas. That was the agreement. Now, what have we seen? Let's just review the past. And what have we seen from the beginning? Well, remember, this was the original area allocated for the Jewish National Home back in 1920 at the San Remo Conference. This was to be the Jewish homeland in 1920. But the Arabs objected to all of that. And in 1921 to 1923, Great Britain divided up Palestine into Transjordan and now a new Palestine. The new Palestine was 25% of the original area. So the new Palestine is to be the Jewish national home now. And Jordan, or it's called then Transjordan, known as Jordan today, was given to Abdullah because his he got kicked out of Saudi Arabia by the Saudis. And so he needed a little kingdom of his own. And because he had helped the Brits during World War I, Churchill said, okay, we'll give you everything to the east of the Jordan River. So now the Jewish national home has shrunk by 75%. Well, the Peel Partition Plan, of course, the Arabs didn't like that either. In the Peel Partition Plan of 1937, what happened to the Jewish home? It was proposed that the Jewish home would now be reduced to the Galilee and the seacoast. That's plenty for the Jews. That's all they need. So now the Jewish national home is reduced to about 10% of the original allotment. What, we weren't done yet. The Arabs objected to that. And the Woodhead Commission partition plan of 1939 now took the Galilee away from the Jewish people. So by 1939, the Jewish state was reduced to the small, small strip along the coast. And of course, the Arabs didn't like that either. But what have we seen up until 1939? We were observing the shrinking Jewish state. Okay? Now, there's a principle in Scripture. There's a principle in Scripture that you see beginning in Genesis 12:3. I will bless those that bless you, and I will curse those who curses you. Now, there's a little refinement to that principle that I'd like to share with you. Basically, when God curses those who curse Israel, it's curse for curse in kind. Curse for curse in kind. What, the way you treat the Jewish people is the way you will be treated. Keep that in mind. Okay? Curse for curse in kind. Well, of course, the Arabs are objecting to the whole idea of a Jewish national home. And in 1947, this was their claim. You know, Palestine is ours. There's no room there for any Jews. Look at, they've just purchased this tiny little bit of land in our territory. We have been there from time immemorial. You know the claim. So this was the Arab claim in 1947. It's all ours. Palestine has nothing to do with the Jews. And by the way, that's still the claim, right? There's still an attempt to rewrite history and say Jewish people never, never had any connection with the land. Well, in 1947, that was the Arabs' claim. But the UN didn't agree, actually, in 1947. And the UN said, well, we're gonna divide up Palestine 50-50. You know, you guys have never accepted any of the plans, so we're going to divide what's left 50-50. The green area will be the Arab-Palestinian home. The white area will be the Jewish national home. Take it or leave it, basically, was the idea. And, of course, the Arabs didn't like that, and so they attacked the new state of Israel in 1948. But much to their surprise, of course, Israel won the war. And from 1949 to 1967, the Jewish state looked like this. Looked like this. And now we come to Oslo II. And guess what's happening? The West Bank is beginning to erode away, isn't it? So what are we observing now? Previously, we were observing the shrinking Jewish state. What are we observing now? The shrinking Palestinian state. Okay? Well, interesting. Curse for curse in kind. You tried to shrink my people out of existence. Guess what? The same may happen to you. We'll have to see where it goes. But, you know, the West Bank now is being divided up piecemeal. The only area you see that's solidly Palestinian is the Gaza Strip these days. So we'll just have to see how the Lord acts in the years to come. Who knows what will happen? We'll have to see. No, I make no predictions other than what we've seen in the past. Okay, let's see. We're on page 250. Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin assassinated. The peace process championed by Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin generated intense opposition in Israel. Those opposing his policies condemned him for nearly 2 years prior to the assassination. For example, September 7th, 1993, tens of thousands protest autonomy accords at Rabin's office. Banners read, "Wanted for treason, Yitzhak Rabin and Shimon Peres." December 1993, American pro-peace group Project Nisham receives death threats against Rabin. One reading, "Kill Rabin, the murderer of the Jews." September 1995, a rabbinic curse placed on Rabin calls for the angels of destruction to kill him. The curse expires early November. October 5, 1995, thousands demonstrate in Jerusalem against Oslo II with effigies of Rabin in a Nazi SS uniform. Likud leader Netanyahu addresses the crowd, which chants, "Rabin is a traitor." Pretty extreme times, huh? Well, turn the page, and from you can read the on the top of 251 some additional examples of what was going on in Israel at that time. Now, on page 251, drop down to "on Saturday evening." That's the third paragraph on page 251. Everybody find that? "On Saturday evening, November 4th, 1995. There was a Peace Now rally at Tel Aviv's Kikar Malchei Yisrael, King of Israel Square. It was packed with 100,000 well-wishers." So the peace process had plenty of supporters as well. Israel was split down the middle over the peace process. A tremendous number opposing it, a tremendous number supporting it. It was packed with 100,000 well-wishers of the peace process. Yitzhak Rabin was there with Foreign Minister Shimon Peres and other Labor Party leaders. Rabin, in obvious pleasure with the size and mood of the crowd, sang a song entitled "Song of Peace" with a leading Israeli singer at the close of the event. He had never sung in public before, which is an indication of how good he felt. Rabin left the platform and headed towards his motorcade. As he walked down the steps of the Tel Aviv Municipality Building to enter his official car at 9:50 p.m., he was felled by an assailant who fired three shots at point-blank range. His wife, Leah, was walking beside him but was not hurt. However, one of his bodyguards was also hit. His bodyguards pushed Rabin into his car and rushed him to the nearby Ichalov Hospital, where he was immediately taken to surgery. Rabin was hit in his back and chest by two dum-dum bullets at point-blank range. A dum-dum bullet is designed to crushes upon impact and causes more, instead of being a smooth hole, it causes a lot more damage. It's designed to kill. He was hit in the chest by two dum-dum bullets shot at point-blank range. At 11:15 p.m., he was pronounced dead by doctors who could not revive him. When it became apparent that the assailant was Jewish, this sent shockwaves through the Jewish world. Shockwaves, you guys. Here is the Tel Aviv Municipality Building and, of course, the square in the front of the Tel Aviv Municipal Building. And here is the stairs. You can see on the left the stairs that Rabin was walking down. And then in the foreground, the monument marking the place of the assassination. And when this picture was taken, you see it was decorated with flowers in remembrance of Yitzhak Rabin. Now let's take a close-up look at the monument. A close-up look at the monument are these stones. Now these stones are placed the way they are in order to symbolize the earthquake that hit the Jewish community when another Jew killed another Jew. One Jew killed another. That a Jewish man would kill the Prime Minister of Israel just literally caused a tremendous earthquake throughout the entire Jewish world. How could we do this to ourselves? So that's the symbolism behind these rocks in disarray. And here's the memorial stone on the front of the display. You can see the inscription. The inscription reads, "Here on this spot, On November 4, 1995, Israel's Prime Minister and Minister of Defense, Yitzhak Rabin, was murdered. Peace shall be his legacy. So if you go to Tel Aviv today, this is the memorial you will see of this event. All right, let's continue on. The confessed assassin was Yigal Amir, 27-year-old law student from Bar-Ilan University. Police said he had no criminal record and was known to be a supporter of the right-wing politics. He did belong to the Jewish extremist organization Eyal, the acronym for Avenging Jewish Organization, which took credit for the assassination. Nevertheless, Amir told interrogators that he acted alone and that he had received instructions from God to kill Prime Minister Rabin. And so you have this picture in the bottom of page 51. This is the young man, Yigal Amir, who performed the deed. All right, page 252. Amir said that he did not regret his deed, which he said was planned for some time. He confessed that he had tried to get close to Rabin on two other occasions. He was armed then, but failed in his attempts. He further revealed that he also planned to kill Foreign Minister Shimon Peres. And he said, if both Peres and Rabin had gone down the steps at the same time, I would not have hesitated to kill them both. World leaders, including Arab leaders, sent immediate condolences. Notables from 86 nations came to Israel for the funeral. 22 presidents, 25 prime ministers in attendance. Both King Hussein of Jordan, Hosni Mubarak of Egypt, attended and spoke of the funeral. Up to now, they had refused to come to Jerusalem. They had both signed peace treaties with Israel, but it was a very cold peace, and they had refused to come to Jerusalem up till now. So this was a catalyst for that. November 5, 1995, some 1 million people filed past Rabin's coffin to pay their respects. And here's a photograph taken during the time. On the left is Yitzhak Rabin's son, and then Leah, the widow, a granddaughter, I believe a daughter, and a grandson. And of course, mourning the death of Yitzhak Rabin. And here is the crowd and the coffin in the foreground. You can see President Clinton here, and also showing up in the photograph, Hosni Mubarak of Egypt. So many, many dignitaries came out of respect for Yitzhak Rabin. And this is the gravesite today of Yitzhak Rabin and Leah. This is marking where they rest together. All righty. Continuing on, yet others in the Arab world celebrated the assassination. Reports from Syria and Lebanon reveal that those opposed to the peace process in the Arab world fired guns, artillery, anti-tank rockets into their air in celebration of Rabin's death. Anti-aircraft fire lit up the night sky over several parts of Beirut, which was inhabited by Muslim extremists, who immediately celebrated the news of Rabin's death. And they didn't want nothing to do with the peace process. The new head of the Islamic Jihad group, Ramadan Abdullah, said of Rabin's assassination, I do not regret the death of the foremost head of terrorism in the world. What is it? The world loses one of its killer criminals. Palestine Liberation Organization leader Yasser Arafat did not attend the funeral after Palestinian and Israeli officials reportedly told him that his presence in Jerusalem would provoke security problems. Probably true. Probably would have started a riot. On November 8, 1995, Yitzhak Rabin's confessed assassination, Yigal Amir, told the judge he had made a cold-hearted decision to kill the prime minister and stop the peace process. He told the judge that he drew his ideas from halakha, the Jewish legal code. Quote, according to halakha, you can kill the enemy. My whole life I learned halakha, he said. When you kill in war, it's an act that is allowed. Page 253. I did this to stop the peace process, he said. We need to be cold-hearted. The judge, did you act alone? Judge Arbel asked. It was God, Amir replied. A grieving Leah Rabin blamed those who incited right-wingers for her husband's death. Incitement? Sure, absolutely there was incitement, Rabin said in a television interview recorded before Yitzhak Rabin's funeral. By week's end, Israeli police had arrested 8 suspects in connection with the killing. Still, militants from the right appeared uncowed by the clampdown. In one incident, 2 Jerusalem yeshiva students were sentenced to 6 days in jail for trying to desecrate Rabin's grave. Both spat on it, and police said one appeared to be appearing to urinate on it. Well, with that behind us, let's move on page 253 to Shimon Peres. And of course, this is now the acting minister, Shimon Peres. So we have just a list of his career highlights. 1923, born in Poland. 1934, immigrated to Palestine, later educated at Harvard and New York universities. 74 to 77, he was defense minister under Rabin. 84 to 86, he was prime minister. 92 to 95, foreign minister under Rabin. 1994, shared the Nobel Peace Prize with Rabin and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat for efforts toward the Israeli-Palestinian reconciliation. So he is a major player in the history of the modern state, isn't he? November 20th, 1995, U.S. News and World Report printed the following assessment. Ehud Barak, Israel's interior minister, is a former chief of staff of Israel's military, a Rabin protege, and Israel's most decorated soldier. He is likely to be a prime player in any new labor government, and we will see that that prediction was quite accurate. All right, turn the page, 254. 1996, at the top of the very top of the page, the first Palestinian elections, Arafat is elected president. Was that unexpected? Not exactly. Now, you see the Oslo II chart there. We're looking again at that third column. And in the third column, when the next step is taken, remember Oslo II, described as the comprehensive agreement to transfer powers. First of all, with an IDF redeployment from West Bank populated areas, and now the next stage, January 20th, 1996, elections to the Palestinian Council. So that is what occurred in accord with the negotiations with Oslo II. All right, then there's just some highlights. February 25th to March 4, Islamic militants carry out 4 suicide bombings in Israel, killing 63. March 28, Yigal Amir is sentenced to life imprisonment. Of course, that's for the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin. Then, April 11, 1996, Israel launches Operation Grapes of Wrath against guerrillas in South Lebanon. Israel began a 16-day air and artillery campaign against guerrillas in South Lebanon. With the Mideast peace talks at a standstill, the Israeli-Lebanon border exploded anew. Lebanon's Iran-backed Hezbollah fighters sent a series of rockets into Israeli towns. Doesn't sound any different than today, does it? No, of course not. It's been going on for a long time. In retaliation, Israel launched deep air attacks into Lebanon, hitting Hezbollah headquarters and reaching to the outskirts of Beirut for the first time in 14 years. Prime Minister Shimon Peres never clearly spelled out the objectives of the operation. However, the idea was clear, to use Israel's overwhelming military and technological superiority to apply precise and selective force in Lebanon until Syria, the dominant power there, remember, Syria is still invading Lebanon and still the dominant power, remember that? Until Syria, the dominant power there, was compelled to curb the guerrillas of Hezbollah. Hezbollah means the party of God, and return to the negotiating table. But the death of scores of Lebanese refugees at the UN base at Qana in southern Lebanon under an Israeli artillery barrage abruptly turned things upside down. Hezbollah remains intact. Friday, April 26, Israel, Syria, and Lebanon agreed to a written set of understandings to stop the 16 days of rocketing and shelling in northern Israel and southern Lebanon. The agreement is designed to protect civilians on both sides of the border. It's unsigned, although simultaneous public announcements of it were made by agreement in Israel, Lebanon, and Syria. Warren Christopher, who spent 7 days shuttling between the parties, made the announcement in Israel, standing next to Prime Minister Shimon Peres, who is in the midst of a fierce election campaign. Now, April 24th. Here's kind of a laughable article. Palestinian Parliament in exile votes to revoke the sections of the charter calling for Israel's destruction. For more than 31 years, the charter of the Palestine Liberation Organization called for Israel's destruction. April 24th, 1996, the fight officially ended without debate. The Palestinian Parliament in exile voted 504-54 to revoke parts of the charter that call for armed struggle against Israel and the liberation of Palestine. Israeli Prime Minister Shimon Peres said if the PLO did not strike the anti-Israel parts from the charter, he would postpone the opening of final status talks negotiations in the peace process scheduled for May 4th. The charter lost much of its force when Arafat signed the Oslo Agreement on the White House lawn in September 1993, ending decades of virtual war between the PLO and Israel. But Israel insisted the process would not be complete until the charter was amended. April 25, 1996, Israel's governing Labor Party dropped its historical opposition to the creation of a Palestinian state. The landmark action matched the Palestinian National Council's equally monumental vote the day before to end its long-standing goal to obliterate Israel. Page 256. The decisions coming as fighting continues between Israel and Hezbollah guerrillas in Lebanon speak volumes about the recent change in the Middle East. A few years ago, such a dramatic Israeli-Palestinian peace current would have been unthinkable while an active battlefront existed between the Jewish state and Arab guerrillas. The Palestinian Council vote helps Peres in his campaign for Israel's national elections May 29th, demonstrating to the Israeli public that Arafat can be trusted and the peace process can produce dividends. Peres called the vote the greatest ideological change of the century. Words are cheap, aren't they? Votes are cheap, aren't they? The reality is very different. You know, if these words and if this so-called change in the covenant were reality, there would have been peace in the Middle East many, many years ago. Many, many years ago. But the reality is very, very different. All right, May 5th, 1996. Negotiations open for the final stage, notice, final stage of the Mideast peace talks. Never have reached the final stage, have we? Never have reached it. Taba, Egypt. Israeli and Palestinian negotiators formally opened the last and most difficult stage of their search for peace settlement. The final status talks that require them to resolve their bitterest differences within 3 years. The session was timed to meet the deadline for the start of the final round of talks as set out in the Israeli-Palestinian agreement signed September 1993 and September 1995. Those agreements declare that the final settlement must be reached by May 1999. It is now 2014. High hopes, huh? One unspoken understanding was that real negotiations would not start until after the May 29th Israeli elections. It was clear to both sides that the talk shape would depend on whether Peres, the Israeli architect of the process, was reelected. The most intractable and most important issues have been saved for last. The status of Jerusalem, the fate of about 3 million Palestinian refugees, the fate of Jewish settlements in Palestine areas, final borders between the Israelis and the Palestinians, security arrangements, and vital economic questions such as sharing water and trade. Big issues. Here is a summary. This is on page 257 of your notebook. We're now looking at the far right-hand column. Stage 2. the permanent status talks. Agreement finalizing the relationship between Israel and the Palestinians. Talks begin no later than the third year of the interim period, May 1996, according to the Declaration of Principles. Issues: Jerusalem, refugees, settlements, security arrangements, and borders. Agreements to enter into force after the fifth year of self-government. So that was the plans. That was the plans. All right, I've got a quarter after. So let's go ahead and take our break for 15 minutes. So listen for the shofar, and we'll pick it up there with the Benjamin Netanyahu becoming the prime minister. So take your break. Okay, let's pick it up then on, let's see, where are we here? Page 257 with May 29th, 1996. Right-wing Likud leader, party leader, Benjamin Netanyahu, narrowly defeats Peres in an election to become prime minister. So you're very familiar with Benjamin Netanyahu's portrait these days. You have this picture on page 257. After Yitzhak Rabin's assassination, Peres moved forward as acting prime minister. In the election polls, he led Likud's Benjamin Netanyahu by a whopping 30%. That's incredible. Had he called for immediate re-elections, with the right still disgraced by the murder, he surely would have won. The terror attacks of late February and early March shattered public confidence in the peace process and destroyed his lead. At the onset of April's Operation Grapes of Wrath in Lebanon, Peres led Netanyahu by 11%. After the army's accidental bombardment of Kfar Kana left 100 Lebanese civilians dead, the lead shrank to 3.7%. By May 12th, when momentum was with Netanyahu, and by the 19th, Bibi was leading the Jewish electorate by 4%. Now he's ahead by 4%. Page 258. The TV debate between Peres and Netanyahu, 2 nights before the election, was now viewed as the final nail in Peres's coffin. Peres did not want to debate Netanyahu. It was an encounter his gut instinct told him to duck. But he acceded to his aide's opinion that staying home was a worse alternative. Tired and underprepared, he was comprehensively outperformed by a vigorous, focused opponent. All right, you can read more of the details about the election of Netanyahu on page 258 and 259. Go to page 259. And June 23rd, some of the events that occurred just in brief, the Arab summit. August 2nd, the government angers Arabs by ending a four-year freeze on settlement construction. September 4th, Netanyahu Arafat meet. September 24th, protests and clash break out in the West Bank, Gaza, and Jerusalem after Israel opens a tunnel near the Muslim holy site. 58 Palestinians, 15 Israelis, and 3 Egyptians are killed. October 1st, 1996, Netanyahu and Arafat hold talks in the White House how to end the violence. November 1996, Har Homa approved. That is a residential development built on Israeli territory that was purchased in 1940, by the way. So this residential development was approved December 16th, 1996, in spite of all this violence, constant violence going on in Israel during this time. The peace talks resume. Israel and Palestinians revive peace talks December 16th, 1996, regarding Israel's long overdue pullout from Hebron, despite tension over Israel's decision to pump more money into West Bank settlements. So you can see 1996 was a year of tremendous strife and violence in the nation. 1997, modern Zionist movement 100 years old. So turn to the top of page 260 now. 1997 was considered the year of Zionism centennial. Zionism was considered 100 years old. That's measured from the first Zionist Congress in Basel in 1897. For those of you who have been with us from the beginning, we started our study of Zionism around the 1830s with a more informal movements. But the Zionist movement reached a formal stage in 1897 with that first Zionist conference. As we entered the centennial year, the Jewish community was, as usual, involved in a debate. The debate: is Zionism over? Have we entered the post-Zionist era? Some said no. By the way, others said yes, and others said maybe. When you have three Jews, you get four opinions, right? So you can read about that debate over Zionism on pages 260 and 261. I'm going to let you read all that material on your own, page 260 and 261. And let's go now to the top of page 262. At the top of page 262, the second paragraph says, "Is Zionism dead?" You define it, you be the judge after reading all that material. But if you define Zionism, I want you to define it from a biblical base, okay? And now this is a good time to review the material we looked at many, 33-some weeks ago about Zionism. What is Zionism? So let me review this material, not only for you folks that have been part of the class, but for anyone who's new. We have to start by asking the question, what is Zion to begin with? Well, the meaning of the name is unknown. Perhaps it means fortress. Now, by the way, this material is found on pages 9 through 13 of your notebook. So way back early is where this material is found. So what is Zion? We really don't know the meaning of the name. Now, here's a map of ancient Israel. Originally, the term Zion identified the southeastern hill, the city of David. That's the area in the circle. It's the southeastern hill lying between the Kidron Valley on the east and the Tyropian Valley on the west. Right in between them is the southeastern hill. Here's another map of the city. A little further along in the city's history. Here's the Tyropian Valley running through the middle of the city. And here's the Kidron Valley running to the east of the city. And right in between them, what's labeled as the lower city, is Mount Zion, or the city of David, or the lower city. Now, there's another valley you need to be very familiar with. That's the Valley of Hinnom. Runs along the southern and western boundaries of the city. So you see the city of Jerusalem is stamped, is marked by three valleys: Valley of Hinnom, the Tyropian Valley, and the Kidron Valley. Now the rabbis noticed that, and they said, guess what? That looks just like the letter Sheen. And so they noticed that the city of Jerusalem was stamped with the letter Sheen. Now there's the letter Sheen. And so the stroke on the left and bottom would represent the Valley of Hinnom. The stroke in the center would represent the Tyropian Valley. And the stroke on the right would represent the Kidron Valley. And by the way, the letter Sheen is a triunity, isn't it? Three strokes making up one letter. Get rid of any of those letters. Do you have a Sheen? You don't have a Sheen anymore, do you? You only have the Sheen when you have a triunity of three strokes. Interesting, because the Sheen is also a Jewish symbol of God, because it's the first letter of Shaddai, Almighty, El Shaddai. You see the Sheen on the right? First letter of El Shaddai. And so it became a symbol of God. Very interesting that a letter that's made up of three strokes would be a symbol of the triune God. And we see it all the time in Jewish culture. For example, here is the word Shaddai and the Sheen on a mezuzah. A mezuzah is a little container you nail to the doorposts of your home containing the little section of scripture you see behind there. And, of course, there's the Sheen on the mezuzah. Now, the command to affix the mezuzah to the door is found in Deuteronomy 6, verses 6 through 9. These commandments that I give you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road and when you lie down and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates. So the Jewish community has always taken that command very literally. And so here's a man in Israel. He's either rented or built this new home. It's his new home, however he acquired it. And it didn't have a mezuzah on the front door. So you see him attaching his mezuzah. By the way, the word mezuzah means doorpost. So he's attaching his mezuzah. In an Orthodox home, you will find mezuzot on every doorpost except the bathroom. And so as you go through those doors, when you go in and out, you will always see the sheen and the word Shaddai reminding you of God. Reminding you that the city of God is stamped with the symbol of God. So these are all reminders to the Jewish people. We need them. We forget all the time, don't we? Not a bad idea to have reminders. One last drawing. Here's the city of David. We have the Kidron Valley to the east, and then to the west, the Central Valley or the Tyropian Valley. And of course, right between the two of them, there's the city of David or Zion, Mount Zion. Now to the north, at a little higher elevation, is Mount Moriah. This is Mount Moriah where the temple would be constructed and the threshing floor of Arunah the Jebusite. It was purchased for the temple, a little bit higher than Mount Zion. Now, how does it look today? If you go to Israel today, this is what you'll see. This is the Kidron Valley, and it's quite a bit shallower than it was in David's day because of all the rubble in it. And there is the city of David. Can you see the Tyropian Valley? You can't see the Tyropian Valley today. It is filled with 80 feet of rubble from all the war. There is one little place where you can actually walk in the Tyropian Valley today, and that is here at the Southern Temple Mount Archaeological Gardens. Right in that area you can walk in the Tyropian Valley. Now, I took this picture from the Herodian level. This is the first century level. These are Herodian stones. This is the material built by King Herod. You can bet your retirement that Jesus walked on these stones. Now, these stones sit upon about 40 feet of rubble. So we're about 40 feet up from the actual bottom of the Tyropian Valley. But notice, here is the modern ground level, right there. So there's approximately 40 feet of rubble to the modern ground level. But you can walk in the Tyropian Valley today, just a tiny, tiny little section of it. And of course, archaeologists are going down underneath the Herodian level and finding tremendous stuff as well. But that's what's left of the Tyropian Valley today. All right, so what is Zion? Originally, it was the southeastern hill. Later, the definition expanded to include Mount Moriah to the north, the Temple Mount. Later on, the definition eventually included all Jerusalem in the thought, then all of Judah, and then all of the Jewish people were included in the definition of Zion. What is Zion? And we see that in Scripture. Here's some examples. In the writings, 2 Samuel 5:7, "Nevertheless, David captured the stronghold of Zion." That is the city of David. So he's speaking of the Jebusite city that David conquered. And as we get into the prophets, many years later, Isaiah writes, "The sons of those who afflicted you will come bowing to you. All those who despised you will bow themselves at the soles of your feet. They will call you the city of the Lord, the Zion, the fortress of the Holy One of Israel." Of course, this prophecy has never been fulfilled yet. Never been fulfilled yet. So that's something that will occur during the Messianic Kingdom. Question?
What is it? Are they bowing to?
To the God of Israel.
Okay,
calling Zion. Well, here Zion is personified. Jerusalem is personified here. Instead of despising Jerusalem, they will revere her. Okay, excuse me. So Jerusalem is, again, associated with the term Zion. And then as we get into the New Testament, here's another one example in the New Testament. But you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to myriads of angels. So we begin with the Jebusite city. The idea of Zion expands to all of Jerusalem, even in the Messianic kingdom, and now to the heavenly Jerusalem in the eternal state. So, Zion and Jerusalem are associated very closely together. Now, if you go to Israel today, and those of you who have not been to Israel will go to Israel sometime. That's an order. I don't know if you can go with me, but you will go to Israel sometime. And you will go to modern Mount Zion, but modern Mount Zion is not biblical Mount Zion. Remember, biblical Mount Zion is to the east of the Tyropian Valley. That's the Tyropian Valley. But here is the Valley of Hinnom, and that is to the west. Now, right between the Valley of Hinnom and the Tyropian Valley sits the upper city, and today it is called modern Mount Zion. It's more correctly called the upper city. And here is modern Mount Zion today. That's the upper city. So don't get fooled. Don't get fooled. If you go to Mount Zion today, it is not biblical Mount Zion. All right? Make sense? The identification is mistakenly put on the upper city. All right, so what is Zionism? We've learned all about Zionism now. It's a complex term. So what is Zionism? What is Zionism? Well, we need to ask for... You're going to get a lot of opinions if you ask what is Zionism. Let's start with a anti-Zionistic Jewish opinion. This website is called Jews Not Zionists. Most Jews do support Jerusalem and the modern state, but some do not. In fact, in this website, you see the statement here, Judaism is opposed to Zionism. And here's what some of their rabbis say. I'll bring those quotes out. The Torah forbids us to strive for reunion or possession of the land by any but spiritual means. So we can't come back to the land using secular means. And Israel is a secular nation today, so it is forbidden in the Torah. Not via our desire did we leave the land of Israel. Not via our power will we come back to the land of Israel. Rabbi Schneerson. In other words, the Messiah's got to bring us back. And he didn't bring us back yet, so the state of Israel is invalid. Rabbi Soloveitchik. Zionists want a state in order to make Jews into heretics. So these rabbis have a very, very negative view of Zionism. In fact, here's a demonstration going on in New York City. We condemn the forbidden and inhumane state of Israel for drafting our children into their army. The website is IsraelVersusJudaism.org. So this is a minority of the Orthodox community, but they definitely exist. And here's another same protest. Read the Talmud. Jews in exile are forbidden to have their own state or army. So they're very, very fervent in their opposition to the modern state. In fact, some are so opposed to the modern state that they're pro-Palestinian. They've gone to Iran. These guys have gone to Iran for an anti-Zionism conference. So again, these are ultra-Orthodox Jews. You know, two Jews, three opinions, you guys. But that is a minority. Well, let's ask Stan Rittenhouse. He's an anti-Semitic Christian. He's an anti-Zionist Christian. He wrote a book, For Fear of the Jews. What does he think of the modern state? In his book, For Fear of the Jews, on page 7, you will read, during the period between the first and second coming of Jesus Christ, a satanic counterfeit, political Zionism masquerading as the state of Israel will be established. So that's his opinion about the modern state. Let's ask the Palestinians. What do they say? Palestinian Charter of 1968, Section 22. And by the way, their opinion has not changed. Zionism is a political movement organically associated with international imperialism and antagonistic to all action for liberation and to progressive movements in the world. It is racist and fanatic in its nature, aggressive, expansionist, and colonial in its aims, fascist in its methods. So that's the Palestinian opinion. And believe me, their opinion has not changed. How about the UN? What do they think of the modern state of Israel? United Nations General Assembly Resolution 3379, adopted November 10, 1975, repealed in 1991. they determined that Zionism is a form of racism and racial discrimination. So, what is Zionism? What is Zionism? Is it a heresy? Is it a satanic counterfeit? Is it a political movement? Is it racism? Well, none of the above, you guys. Here is a biblical definition of Zionism. I've shown you definitions by men. Now, a definition derived from the Bible. The word Zionism describes a feeling. Zionism is an expression of the longing and yearning that the Jewish people have had in the past and still have for their homeland. That's in the material back on page 9 through 13. As soon as any Jew expressed a desire to go back to his land, he is expressing Zionism. That's Dr. Fruchtenbaum's definition. And of course, his stuff is always solidly biblical. So here's one example of how biblical this definition is. Psalm 137, verses 1 through 6. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion. Upon the willows in the midst of it we hung our harps, for there our captors demanded of us songs, and our tormentors myrrh, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How can we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, notice Jerusalem and Zion are synonymous terms here. If I forget you, O Jerusalem, may my right hand forget her skill. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you, if I do not exalt Jerusalem above my chief joy. So Zionism is very biblical in nature, and in Psalm 136 there you can see clearly the emotional longing of the Jewish person for the land of Israel and the city of Jerusalem. So Zionism is defined by the longing of the Jewish people that we have had and still have for our homeland. So don't forget that. Define Zionism biblically. Carol.
Can we get one last set of
slides? You have all this material in verses 9 through 13. Okay? Oh, excuse us, pages 9 through 13.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, it's early in the class. Remember, in the background material, we covered all of that. So just a reminder of what Zionism is. Yes?
So if the question would be, if that's the biblical definition, then can realistically or truthfully, can a Gentile Jew become a Zionist?
Sure.
You could support that.
Yeah.
If it's a feeling and a desire to return to their homeland, then if you're not Jewish, though, you can be a supporter.
Well, you can be, but you're grafted in. Remember, you're grafted in.
Yes, I know.
You know, you're grafted into the place of blessing, the Abrahamic covenant.
Right, I understand that.
Yeah, but while the state of Israel has been given to the Jewish people, you can still support it and still love it. I mean, there's a lot of people in this room that have been to Israel and love Israel. Yeah, so sure. Okay? All righty. So you be the judge. Is Zionism dead? I don't think so. All right, let's take a look here. We've got a few minutes left. January 15th, 1997. Agreement initialed, pullback from Hebron. This is the bottom of the third column there of the chart. You see the third column? The Oslo II interim agreement. Elections to the Palestinian Council. We just looked at that now. The next stage is put into effect. Redeployment from Hebron. That was implemented January 17th, 1998. All righty. February, Israel's worst military air disaster. You can read about that crash between a couple of helicopters. And let's go to page 263. Page 263, February 26, 1997, Har Homa approved. Everybody see that? Everybody get there? Remember, that's that Jerusalem housing expansion that brought a lot of protests, even though it was on Israeli land that was purchased long before. March 7, the cabinet approves a 9% rollback. March 13th, 7 Israeli schoolgirls massacred. That's not a pretty story, but you can read that on your own. You can read about that massacre. Let's go on to March 18th. We're now on page 264. There were protests against Har Homa, so Har Homa was declared a closed military area. Building began. March 21st, there was a bombing in Tel Aviv. May 6th, the Palestinian Authority gets tough on selling land. Basically, what happened there is they began executing any Palestinian selling land to Israelis. If you sold your land to an Israeli, you suffer the death penalty. All righty, next major event then. June 4th, 1997, Barak becomes the Labor Party head. A year after Israeli voters drove it from power, the Labor Party bid anew for the premiership by anointing Ehud Barak, a tough-minded general, as its standard bearer. And of course, you have this picture on page 264, Ehud Barak. Barak, 55, held a comfortable lead in the balloting in the early morning hours for the job of leading his battered party to elections by 2000. On his way to victory, he nudged aside former Prime Minister Shimon Peres. Israel's most decorated soldier possesses savvy and self-confidence. He is respected for his integrity and tell it like it is style. He embodies clarity and precision, traits that the Israeli public find lacking in most politicians at a time of great domestic uncertainty. He was born at the Mediterranean coastal kibbutz of Mishmar HaSharon, 1942, to Eastern European immigrants. Barak held most senior positions in the Israeli army, including chief of military intelligence and the head of what Israeli soldiers call the unit, the elite Sayeret Matkal Commando Force, page 265, top of the page. He won the Distinguished Service Medal, Israel's highest military honor, with four citations, two for operations which are still secret. I wonder what he's been involved in. I'd like to see a book about his life. In 1972, he led a team of commandos disguised as airport maintenance men who had stormed a Belgian airliner and that had been hijacked to Israel. Among the commandos at Barak's side during that raid was Benjamin Netanyahu, now head of the opposition Likud party. So isn't this interesting? You've got two guys in the same commando union, and now they're at opposite ends of the spectrum. One's in Labor and one's in Likud. Now they're running for the premiership. Only in Israel. Only in Israel. The next year, Barak donned a woman's wig and slipped into Beirut, part of a commando team that gunned down three leaders of the Palestine Liberation Organization. 1988, he orchestrated the assassination in Tunis of the PLO's top military strategist, Abu Jihad, considered by Israel to be the mastermind behind the Intifada, the Palestinian uprising in the occupied territories. So this guy has been really, really active, hasn't he? In politics, as an assassin, in the commando units. Quite a life. Quite a life. Anyway, he's now the leader of the Labor Party. Amid all this, July 29, 1997, peace talks resume. All right, you can read about that on your own. July 30th, Mahane Yehuda bombing. That's the marketplace. Big open market, the Mahane Yehuda market. Bomb there. September 4th, Ben Yehuda Street. That's in Jerusalem. Double bombing in Ben Yehuda Street. September 26th, a so-called PA crackdown. So amidst all this turmoil that's going on, foment that's going on, the peace talks resume in 1997. So you can read about that. Go to page 266. So the peace talks resumed, then Netanyahu and Arafat met. Now, we're in page 266, about the middle of the page, December 10th, 1997. This is where we'll pick it up next week. We've only got about 2 minutes left. December 10th, 1997, anti-witnessing bill proposed, okay? A bill to restrict believers from sharing their faith in Israel was introduced. Boy, 1997, 1998, we were very concerned about what happened in Israel if this bill ever got passed. So we're going to look at the details of this starting next week. So let me go ahead and pray. We'll pick it up on page 266 with the anti-witnessing bill. Father, again, we stop and pause and look to you, and we see that amidst a tremendous amount of turmoil in the nation has survived. Boy, the 90s were a tough time in Israel. And we're grateful that all the terrorist activities inside the nation pretty much have ceased now due to the security wall that was put up. So we're grateful for that. But then the main activity now comes from outside the borders of Israel. Anyway, Lord, you've preserved the nation in the past. You will continue to preserve her again. Help us to always remember that you will preserve us through tough times as well. So we lift ourselves up to you in Yeshua's name. Amen. All right, we'll see you next week.